Have you ever committed to a process knowing that you wouldn't see the results for more than a year? It's not something we typically hear about very often in today's world of fast and faster technology. Most things being talked about and shared online for ceramicists and potters are shortcut solutions, quote unquote, providing us ways to skirt around the need to simply spend the time on a skill, to explore it, to test it, to fail at it, to learn from it, and finally, to improve and make and create and say something to the world through our art. Social media makes it feel like instant gratification is normal, and that if you aren't seeing instant results, well, there must be something wrong with you. But really, peeling back the story of some of the most successful ceramicists and makers of our current time, typically you'll find that the perceived success is actually years of commitment. On the good days and the bad days, through the public successes and the lesser known failures. And today on the podcast, we have who I would dub as one of those currently famous ceramicists. I'm getting anxious talking about it because today, my chat this week with Virgil Ortiz is packed with insights. From pragmatic business advice like protecting your intellectual property to the less tangible topics of manifestation and trusting that things have a way of working out. The story of the history of clay for the Cochiti people and how Virgil's work truly, almost accidentally, and yet oh so beautifully connects generations of storytellers is nothing less than astonishing. So I'm going to quit rambling and let's just get right into it after a real quick word from our sponsor.
Hi, I'm Kara, content creator and Facebook wrangler for Amoco Brent, bringing you ideas and support for your creative adventures every day. This week's episode is brought to you by Amoco Brent. Find your favorite Amoco glaze at your local distributor. Happy glazing.
Now, on with the show. Welcome to the Maker's Playbook, the show where we talk all about what it's really like to make a living from the things you make. I'm your host, seasoned entrepreneur of 13 years, Rebecca Ikes Cara. Hey, Virgil, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. This is exciting.
I'm excited. I don't know why you're excited, but I'm excited.
Nice.
I don't know how many ceramicists actively working in the world first name is Virgil, so I feel like most people will know who I'm talking to. But just in case, let's make it explicit. How would you introduce yourself?
Hey, everybody. My name is Virgil Ortiz. I am from Cochiti, Pueblo, New Mexico. I do a bunch of different types of art, working on a bunch of different mediums. But the heart and soul of everything I do is ceramics.
How long have you been working in ceramics? Was ceramics the first medium?
Yeah, it was. I was born into a family of potters on our mother, Severina Ortiz, side of the family. And our grandmother, Laurencita Herrera. So they were all potters. And my siblings and I am the youngest of six kids. And we all grew up just working with clay on a daily basis.
What a dream. I don't know what the actual reality, like, I feel like, do some of your siblings hate clay now at this point?
No, most of them don't work with it. We love it. Like, we were never forced to do it. So that was probably one of the best ways we could have been taught, just brought along with to collect all of our materials and learn the old school methods that they used to, that they still do here in Cochiti Pueblo. Yep. But no, I mean, not at all. Like, it was a fun thing to do. It was very different from all the other kids at school where I thought everybody did it, first of all, and slowly found out, like, not all families did pottery. So that was kind of cool to know that.
I was binging The Shop Callers, your podcast, recently. I went back to, like, the very beginning, but I'm going to probably ask some of the same questions just in case people haven't listened, or they should just probably go to The Shop Callers and listen to your backlog of episodes.
Thank you so much.
I was listening to you talk about how you kind of were working in your hometown with the traditional methods and really were already fairly advanced in your career before kind of coming into the world with Simon and all these other firing techniques and materials and tools. Can you kind of walk us back to beginning of your career and how that transpired into today?
Yeah, definitely. Like I said earlier, we always grew up working with clay because like our mother would always be working with clay on the dining room table, which was her studio. So every morning we wake up, there goes mom. She's already working with clay. When I get back from school, same thing. So she'd always just say like, hey, you know, you're welcome to join in and try it. So it's stuck with me. I have pieces that our mom had purchased when I was like 6 years old. So I have those pieces that thankfully still in my cabinets, right? But yeah, around 15 years old, like I was the last one to fly the coop out of our house. So I was able to watch how our parents interacted with the buyers that would come around from galleries and then get to know them. So when I was like 15 or 16, I had that connection to a couple of the gallery buyers that would visit the Pueblo for buying trips. And that way I was comfortable. I was able to talk to them and slowly I was able to get into the galleries that way. And once I got into the galleries, I really just made those relationships. First of all, I couldn't be afraid to talk to anybody. I had to really do the groundwork and speak my mind of how I would want to show or set up a show, basically. Doing that when I was like still in high school kind of makes me laugh because like looking back, but just having the full support of our parents and any questions that they knew. And by that time, I started really branching out, doing everything myself. I mean, like anything else that you do, the more you do it, the better you get at it. I never went to higher academia or nothing besides high school. So I knew at the age of probably 16 that I was going to dedicate my life to clay and why I was born in here on this earth and this time now. So that was revive all the subject matter and like just the styles of how our people worked in clay in the 1800s. Some of the pieces that one of the collectors, Robert Gallegos, he was a buyer that he knew me since I was 6 years old. So he opened his home and all of his resources, and it turned out that he had the largest collection of these historic works. So I had that direct link to him so I could go down there to his showroom and study all these pieces and learn more about them. Because most people, not even coaching people, knew that all these historic figurative pottery existed. And at that time, Kojiti was known for the storyteller figure, which is basically linked to how we pass down all of our traditions, our language, our ceremonies is through storytelling. Our language isn't written. So once that's how the figurative pottery in the maybe around the 60s it started in Kojiti, of like a grandmother holding her kids or a grandfather or even animals. And that became a tradition in Kojiti. So that's, I grew up learning how to make a storyteller figure. And I guess just me having ADHD or whatever you call it, just bouncing around, like I kind of got bored with making the same thing over and over again. And then I started creating all these different types of figurative pottery, painting them like I've never painted them before. And it wasn't until Robert Gallegos had invited us down to his house that I was exposed to these pieces from the historic times and made that connection because first of all, our parents and I like flipped out when we went into his showroom for the first time because we didn't have any idea what collection he had. And it turned out he had the largest collection of these historic figurative pottery that my experimental pottery looked exactly like without seeing them. Wow. So yeah, that was like the magic point of how my whole career got started, was just to having my parents freak out the same way I freaked out and pulled me outside of the showroom and said, like, remember this day, it's a special day because all of these pieces that you're making, we never taught you how to do it, but your direct connection to our spirits, our ancestors that have passed. And, you know, without you knowing any of that, you made them exactly the same way. So yeah, that's how I figured that I wasn't going to go to higher education.
That's a pretty solid sign. I don't know that most of us get that clear of a, hey, here's hundreds of years of work. You've never seen it. And you're also making it. Like,
and that's how, I mean, yeah, like we had a huge aha moment then. And then I was like, okay, this is what I have to do. I have to revive these pieces. And having the important resource of Robert, having those pieces and me getting to go pick them up and look at them and talk to him about them and, you know, just like exchanging ideas, then that's when it clicked in my head that I could continue this and revive this whole tradition of figurative making pottery from Kojiti and really make that connection and explain it to our people that, like, no matter what subject matter you're making, it falls within our ancestors, what they're doing. Because when you look at it, they're basically recording a timeline and mm-hmm. of anything that was happening in the Pueblo area, like when more people started arriving to the Pueblos and via the newly laid railroads in this area. So it brought more people, more tourists, whatever, more entertainment attractions. So all these different types of shows, operas or circuses started to pop up. So anything that the Pueblo people were exposed to, they captured their caricatures in clay. And that's how they were making a timeline and recording what happened.
Wow. I feel like most of this conversation is going to be me pausing for a really long time after you tell a story, because it's just completely different also than the quote unquote canon. Now, like, I didn't go to higher education for pottery, so I'm kind of totally clueless and learning a lot, but it's just such a, there's just so much more weight and importance, if you will, in terms of, not to undermine, like, those of us that are just making functional ware and wanting to create a space for people to commune together and share a meal, and that's important, but this is a whole different thing. And I guess I didn't actually realize that the figurative work that you're doing now has such a connection with the historical. I was thinking it was more of a tangential connection of, rather than the literal, like mm-hmm. the process of the making and the figures themselves and whatnot, because they are so modern also mm-hmm. in a way, you know what I mean? There's like a timelessness, I guess.
Yeah, I totally want to expose or like show off these pieces from the 1800s, and Robert Gallegos has a lot of these images of them. So hopefully I can find some time to actually talk about them and show the public what I'm doing. Because a lot of people think I'm doing it for shock factor, like having all these different club people or whatever I've seen in on the underground clubs, right? Like S&M and latex and vinyl and all that. Mm-hmm. But it basically falls in line with what our people were doing. Like anything new that we've seen, they recorded it. So captured it in clay. So I'm using the clay as a storyteller and giving voice back to the clay of all the, who knows how many of these artifacts and these clay works were destroyed. Like when the first invaders came into the area, they destroyed tons of our artwork and especially a lot of the clay works, because the people were accused of like sorcery or witchcraft having all these types of works. And so they put a stop to what we're doing. So now, like, I feel that I'm giving voice back to the clay and, you know, making more timelines in wherever city that I go to with my friends. And all of those, that type of work resonated with me when I would go to the underage clubs, the underground clubs, and the metro cities. Would travel to, like, when I was still in high school with my friends, and we'd see all these cool, you know, fashion magazines come to life, things that we couldn't afford, but we could see them live in the clubs. Yeah. So when I get back home, I record those in clay and really have a story to tell about, not only to my family, but whoever would want to know. But it falls in line again with what all of our ancestors did to record all of the different, like the Spanish people that were here. And there was like prostitution back in the day. So they recorded all of that. And a lot of the script that they were writing were painted onto the pottery. So it was much more explicit than what I'm doing now. Now I have the resources, images and stuff from these historic pieces to refer to, like have all, like anybody from the Pueblo would ask me, like, what are you making? What are those about? Then I show them, like, you know, this is what our grandpa and grandparents did. And then they're like, oh, I get it. Okay, keep doing more. So now they understand when they never, you know, they always thought that Kojiti made storyteller figures. They did. They were called singing mothers, but they got renamed storyteller by one of the women here in Kojiti, that her name was Helen Cordero. So she named them that, and that's how they became popular. So that's what Kojiti is known for. We're the first Pueblo that made these storyteller figures, and then now all the other Pueblos do it. But it's just a way of how to unleash and revive all the original, say, storyteller figures back in the day.
There's such a, what's the right word? Discrepancy, I guess, in my mind, to think of how like a culture and a making practice can be uplifted so strongly from even like your parents already having gallery connections, which mm-hmm. in my world, like work in galleries is capital A art, right? Like it's a big yeah. deal. And yet at the same time, you have this massive destruction of culture. And it's like, how was it that people could uplift something in one hand And in the other hand, be like, oh, no, you can't do that. Like, you can't, mm-hmm. that's not okay. Like, it's just, this isn't really a question, but it's just, I don't know, a reckoning as you're talking. It's like, this doesn't make sense. Like, yeah. It should have just been, you know, the uplifting of galleries, if you will.
Right. And our people survived this, all the, you know, colonizations and all that. And that's like another main reason why I work with traditional clay and like why I'm so, why that's my life. And why I thought, why I know I'm here to do is because like the 1680 Pueblo Revolt, most people don't know about it. And, you know, like it's, we've been tried to, you know, be buried and not acknowledge it. And that's what I want people to acknowledge what happened in our history and to, so that we can accept it, understand it, acknowledge it and move forward into peace. And that's what I'm trying to do is educate globally using artwork of our history that has been swept under the carpet. It's not even taught in schools or our history books and all. And for it to be America's first revolution, it's, you know, they don't want to talk about it or educate about it because of the bloodshed, the genocide, the rape, the everything that went on. And, you know, I'm slowly telling that whole story and building a whole world about it. And I love science fiction, so that's why I'm telling the story happening simultaneously in two different time dimensions of 1680 and 2180. So having a feature film in mind, and this is how I'm having the characters time jump back and forth and through wormholes and, but telling the same story. So going back to my love of science fiction, I'm able to create all these different characters, especially using the high fire clay now, which I never knew existed before. Cause like until like maybe 2015 or 14, I believe. My whole world was about traditional ceramics. And that means when I say traditional, is that we go dig our own clay, we make all of our own paints or glazes, fire with cedar and aspen wood and cow manure. And it's just like the old school methods. And, you know, I kind of had blinders on, which I feel that it's really good that I did until like 2014, because I knew exactly and learned from our mom, our grandmother, our dad, of how to utilize what we have from the earth itself. Yes, clay is everywhere, even though the high fire clay is like, you know, manufactured and all that, but it's still from Earth Mother. And now that these different venues are opening for me to tell the story and to really do or show what our ancestors didn't have the opportunity, you know, they didn't have social networks at all or internet, right? So all the different resources now that I'm coming into contact with, I'm able to really spread the word and educate more about what our people do as far as the pottery and what it's about.
Well, and before, just to like give everybody super low level clarity, because I know there's everybody listening from all over the world, and whether English is a first language, a second language, a third language, et cetera, just so we have total clarity, when you talk, because you still live in the same hometown, right? You're still in the same spot?
I do. Cochiti Pueblo. It's located between Santa Fe and Albuquerque in New Mexico.
Cool. And when you talk about the Pueblo as a place or also as like a community, like how would you define? Because I think I have my understanding, but I just want to make sure also that it's super clear as we continue the conversation that people kind of understand the structure is not the right word, but you know what
I mean? Yeah, they're little communities of indigenous people, Pueblo people. So like back in the day, it was like over more than 45 Pueblos along the Rio Grande River. And after all this time, there are 19 Pueblos remaining in New Mexico. So we each have our reservations along the Rio Grande. And the Pueblos are, I mean, we all speak different dialects. Like we can understand maybe like the north or south Pueblos from us, but the further away it gets, I mean, it's not even far away. It's like 30 miles if you go directly like to it. And yet we all have different dialects, which is crazy to think of, and just how many people there were back in the day. But yeah, they're little communities and it's basically a huge family. When I was a kid, I took it for granted because we knew everybody and it seemed like everybody were cousins and everybody helps when someone has a brand new, a newborn or through life, like all different life's festivities or whatever, or all the way until death. Like we all support each other. We pray together. We have the ceremonies, the dances, everything. And it's all done as a huge family. So I know a lot of people don't have this kind of connection to their communities, which is like blows my mind. And that took it took a while for me to understand that, you know, slowly having friends that are non-Indigenous people, meeting their families. Like, okay, so where else is the rest of your family? They're like, well, that's it. And I'm like, wait, what? Definitely a huge learning curve and to realize what we have in these individual pueblos. So yeah, it's all a big community. It's a big family. And it's amazing to be a part of it.
That's fantastic. I don't have the same cultural background, but I do remember the first time I went to a college friend's house for, I don't know, her birthday or graduation or something, and she has no cousins, and I have a lot of cousins. Right. To where I was like, where is everybody? Why is it so quiet? Like, what's going on?
Yeah, there's a huge difference. I mean, like all the feast days and everything, everybody reconnects, and people that have moved away from the pueblo, they all come back to participate. And that's a warm feeling. And, you know, as the more my career has grown over the years, and like, I'm hardly here at the pueblo. I usually like maybe 3 months out of the whole year that I'm here, like beginning through May, then June, July, August. And our largest show that we participate in is called the Santa Fe Indian Market, which happens the third weekend in August. So over the summer, I'm completely preparing for that. And also our annual feast day where everybody joins in at Cojedi is July 14th. So I know those are some of the dates that I have to be here. And when a majority of like everybody's families come back into town for that. So it's fun to be here for that. And I've been dancing in this feast day dance since I was a kid. And, you know, I'll keep on doing it until I can't dance anymore. But it's just amazing to have that and just revisit with everybody. And now that we're still going through this pandemic, and, you know, that really felt weird when all of the Cojedi kind of shut down. We couldn't visit anybody. We still don't really visit anybody now just because of the protocols that we followed, but it helped a lot. We survived. But to have the gatherings of all the ceremonies and all, I know everybody missed that. And then it feels weird when I'm working because I'm always on the road. And, you know, to hear or, you know, text from my family and say like, oh, we're doing this dance today. I'm like, oh my God, I don't want to be home. But it's just, you know, I've been doing it my whole life. So like, I just dig deep into memory, reminisce about what we're thinking, all the food, all the prayers, all the fun with family, everybody gathering together. So that is part of the re-energizing method that I use, and touching the clay, no matter where I'm at, always grounds me back to Cojedi.
What's like your kind of typical schedule look like now? Because I didn't realize you had, I mean, I knew you were traveling, but not three quarters of the year. That is, that's a lot.
It's insane. I'll come back to check on the house and the studio and all. And like, luckily I have some family members that my sister Joyce and my nephew Dominic, they reside in the pueblo. So they're able to take care of the households. I love doing museum shows or exhibitions, or I never used to do workshops before, but now that I have the experience to work with high fire clay, you could go to any ceramic store, buy the material there, use a kiln, and teach workshops at universities and stuff. That whole network, that circuit has grown. So I love doing it and connecting because, you know, it's about me teaching people, but in fact, I'm learning more from the students or anybody that takes the workshop. So I love doing that as well. And that's a re-energizing type of work that I do.
Well, and just pragmatically, I'm thinking like, if your only really extended period of time in your own studio is those 3 months, like, is there a, what I'm envisioning is that's got to be a very intense period of making, because you're basically making what I assume to be like a year's worth of work.
I mean, I still have pieces that I haven't worked on for 2 years. So they're like, they're built, like, they're already dried and they're ready to be sanded and painted, right? So this is all, I was taught to never overproduce using the traditional methods of materials. Our parents taught us to only do it when, especially if your family or your friends need help or, you know, for certain shows and stuff, but don't overproduce. So I have that other resource of using high fire clay for experimentation, and especially using colors and the textures and all the different techniques of firing, which I never knew about until I started doing all these workshops and meeting people along the way. And then, like, say, Instagram, which we operate most out of, connecting with non-Indigenous ceramics, people that do the shows. And that was like a big, I don't know if you heard that episode, like how we started and how I started to mesh and mingle with all non-Indigenous ceramics. It was called Periscope. And that was like a live broadcasting app, right? Like via Twitter. So there's a little community that we made off of Instagram. So like, hey guys, we're going to be broadcasting from Periscope, you know, from 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock, we'll be at my studio. you know, there was like a handful of potters that we just kind of pushed each other. And then I was like, whoa, this is insane. How is like everybody's taking the clay out of the same bags? How do I get those bags to put my clay in? And I was like, wait, are you getting them from the same source or what is going on? So it was just funny because I never set foot in a ceramic store before. So it wasn't until I started making friends, and Neil Chalani was one of the first people that took me into Santa Fe Clay Ceramic Store. At that time, he was living in Greeley, Colorado, and we started hanging out, and he came down to Santa Fe and took me there, and I flipped out just looking at all the prepackaged clay, and because it takes us a whole year to process our materials, like using traditional materials. So to have it available, like you open the box and open a bag of clay and it's ready to go.
Right.
And, you know, you could choose the color, the texture, and then traditional colors are red, white, and black in Kochiti, but to have the opportunity to use metallics or green or pink or whatever color you want, and that's available. So I'm having, needless to say, I'll never stop having a blast finding more of what ceramics is about, the high fire.
Oh my gosh. I mean, on the one hand, I feel like it's like all of a sudden Technicolor dream coat, right? Mm. It's opening up a world. On the other hand, I can only imagine the depths of value in sourcing all of your own materials, because one thing I noticed that's kind of a catch-22 for people getting into ceramics outside of traditional method is the default is to buy things from suppliers all the time, which is or is not sustainable as far as like the actual cost of having a ceramic studio, right? Like when someone has the means to go and buy a brand new electric kiln, they don't actually know how the kiln's working. So if something breaks, then they have to pay somebody to come to their house to fix it, and they're stuck. And that's also just a lot of, it's expensive, you know, as opposed to figuring out your own solutions and creating your own supplies. And, you know, like, yeah, it's a heck of a lot more work, but at the same time, you're kind of in control of the process in a way that is, I don't know, financially manageable. I don't even know if that's accurate, but.
Yeah. No, it's amazing because like as far as firing and stuff, we have to have the wood cut. And thank God I have nephews that love to go chop wood because it's like you have to have them stored and dried and bone dry, right? And then collecting the cow manure that we do, we have to go to the fields and get all the cow pies, bring them home to the barn, store them so that they're bone dry when we use them. So there's just all these different that to take into consideration all the steps and procedures. And it takes a whole year. And, you know, because I grew up with it since I was 6 years old, that I can remember that it didn't seem like it was a lot of work to me. But when I try to make that connection of how anybody from Kochiti that wants to learn how their family members or grandparents used to make pottery, they're all excited and I'm willing to share everything that I know. But once we start, you know, I'm going to show you the whole process. Here we go. We're going to go get clay. We're going to go get the temper, you know, go collect the wild spinach. And this is how long it takes. And they're like, wait, what? We thought like, you know.
I can't go home with a bowl today.
Yeah. So it's like, well, let's go let it process and I'll show you how to do it. And, you know, a lot of them live outside of the Pueblo and they have families. So they have normal jobs, 9-to-5 jobs, and they don't have the time to do this. And because it's a lot of time that you dedicate to use the old school methods and materials. And, you know, it's a dying art form. And this is why I feel I'm also here, is to make that connection to whether it be people of my age or the next generation, to make sure that they understand and know where to get these resources from and how to work with them. And just making sure that that connection and that it's still intact when I'm out of here.
I was smiling so much because when you were talking about collecting cow patties, all I could think about is if my grandpa was still alive, my maternal grandfather, my mom grew up on a farm, he would be like, you can come out anytime. Like he would, I could just hear him like, that would have been gold to hit. Like it would have just would have been, he was a really funny guy. So I can just see how that would have gone.
Yeah, another fun part of it is like, you know, my nieces and my sisters will be screaming because we all have like sticks, flipping them over.
Yeah.
Because we have to go like
dry them. Right? Point.
Yeah, flip them over to dry. And they're usually centipedes, like the huge ones in here in New Mexico. They look like Jurassic Park style. They're like 8 inches long and they're super quick. And oh, yeah, everybody's screaming. So that's another funny memory that still exists when we go flip the cow pies and gather them.
I mean, I don't know if that's better or worse than like where my memory goes is my cousins would always drive ATVs, like four wheelers, to herd cattle and whatnot. And I would be like behind them holding on because they never let me drive. Not that I'm bitter about it, but they would have the, they had this skill where they could hit them at just the right angle that it got all over me, but didn't get on them somehow.
Like,
that's what I think of.
Yeah, it's memories, right? And reminiscing all that.
Yeah.
And that's just like what connects me. And like, I know it's a lot of work. Like I told you, when I try to teach people, then they're like, what the hell? That's like way too much work. I'm like, oh yeah, I forget. So it's just like when with our family members, our nieces and nephews, the younger ones, when we go gather the materials, I try to remember what I felt like or what we did when our grandfather, our grandmothers, our family, our mothers, all went to go collect these materials. Like they make a like a picnic lunch and we just go into the mountains and gather all this material. And it was always fun. So yeah. I try to make it that type of atmosphere, environment when we go. And afterwards, I'm like, okay, we're all going to go to a movie. I'll take you guys all out to go eat. So just have a small reward in the end. Yeah. But we definitely need as many hands to go. And the family members that do create in clay, we split the materials when we get back home. Then we process it for a whole year. So it just, it all works together.
That was going to be one of my questions, just pragmatically speaking, because I want to learn so much more about the history and the culture and so much stuff that I didn't know. Because to your point, we didn't learn any of this in school, you know, even though I was in the same country, none of it's taught. But I'm going to attempt to stay in my lane and talk about what it's like just functionally and pragmatically to do this, just because I know I don't have a half day to interview you. I can't chat for 5 hours as much as I would love to. But how does that work pragmatically in terms of it? Because it sounds to me like you have your family members and you have a whole community that's helping source all of this, just as far as the number of hands you need to gather and to get everything. Is that?
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing just because, like, I mean, we have to go to a certain clay vein that our people have been using for who knows how long, you know, and it's like, I just copy what my parents showed us how to do it. We only take as much as we can carry because we have to climb up like 30 minutes to hike to the clay vein and then carry them down in 5 gallon buckets back to the vehicles. And yeah, it's a definite workout. So you definitely need people that can, you know, are used to cardio going back up and down the mountain and bringing back the clay. It's still damp. It's still moist. And like you have to let it dry because if you try to water it down, screen it, there's still going to be clumps of pure clay and that produces cracks and explosions. So we have to go to another part of the Pueblo to get the pumice stone, volcanic ash. And that's what we use as a temper to mix with that. I guess like a grog, I guess. I think that you say that, but we have to get those. And once we have the clay drying for a whole year, that's when we basically, when we know it's usually bone dry, then crack it up into smaller pieces, slowly rehydrate it. And when you rehydrate it, it rehydrates evenly and there's no like solid clumps of clay. So you're able to then mix it with sifted like to 3 different screens of the volcanic ash. And then you mix it together because the clay is so pure. You can't, you know, it's sticky. It's so sleek. You have to mix it with a grog. Mix it with that. Then you're able to sculpt with it. But then another part is when we make our clay, I mean, our paint, our black paint. Traditional colors are red, white, and black. The clay, when it comes out of the earth, is red. And then we have the whole base of the pottery when we're going to paint it is all white. So we, after it's dried and sand it down and light coating of water, removes the dust, stick it in the oven if it fits in your oven. If it doesn't, you have to build a fire outside to heat it up. And then you slowly apply like up to 10 layers of the another white clay slip on top of it. And people said it was like bentonite, but the more I talk about it and I like, you know, share stories with my friends that are non-indigenous ceramic people, they say like, well, it like turn into the gelatinous, like after you leave it for a while, does it separate? It does separate, but it doesn't like get gelatinous like I guess bentonite does. So it's completely something else. And you apply that and when the piece is hot, evaporates, sticks to it, fills in more of the porousness of the piece. And eventually the piece becomes white. It's still kind of chalky like filling, rag polish it by hand, and it turns into a glossy surface. And once that it's a glossy surface, at that point you can't have anything dirty touch it, like oily hands or no matter how many times you wash your hands, that you still have oils coming out of it. And like, we only have the firing process only one time, and that's the last process in the whole procedure. So we paint the whole thing, but like, to have our paint, we're putting black designs on it, fine, on a smooth surface. So the black paint is made from wild spinach, and I definitely need my family to do that, because I can make small batches by myself, but it's like over a week to do that. So to make a huge batch with my whole family, it's probably a little over a week and a half, 2 weeks almost, but you have to pick just the leaves alone and no stand, no nothing. There's no shortcuts. I tried to do shortcuts, but it didn't work out. So it's like, I know, Mom, you taught me the right way. I just should never like try to shorten the process, but you have to pick the leaves only, boil them for about a week. When I do it with my family, like, we have like five huge pots boiling of water with just the leaves, and then it slowly starts to separate the leaves, and at a point we strain it out with cotton rags again and twist it, get as much juice as we possibly can, because that's what we're after, just the juice. Keep boiling it again, slowly starts to evaporate, then it thickens up, so we start to combine all of the different pots together. And finally, about a week and well days later, then it's starting to get thick, almost lava-like. And at that point, it's maybe half a gallon left of the juice after five huge pots of boiling water. Then it's small. Then at that point, I could take it indoors. Usually my nephews watch the fire because it's like 24/7. And I come inside and I'm able to put it on the stove. And I keep boiling and I have to keep a close eye on it. And it's just there's no timing of it, because we don't really have the amounts of how long you're supposed to boil it per amount of how much juice we had or how much we started with. But you just kind of watch how the liquid is boiling. And at that point, it's kind of making candy apple, the hard shell ones, like how it's boiling like that. It's literally like lava, right? You just have to watch it, because if you burn it, it will not stick to the polished white clay slip. So you burnt it and you wasted like 2 weeks of your life trying to make the natural paint. So you just have to watch it really closely, pull it off the heat. And we already have like dried corn husk ready to carry it. So we spread it and distribute it on the corn husk around the 6 month mark. Then it's still like taffy. It's really soft. Still, you can bend it. Around the year mark, then it turns really hard, like a Jolly Rancher, like what I normally use the descriptions to describe it. And yeah, you can crack them off and then crush it up, rehydrate, and that's what the black paint is. So you're decorating the whole pot, and if you accidentally touch like a piece that's supposed to be, you want the piece white, but you accidentally have a dirty hand or something, you'll touch it, but you won't even find out until after it's fired, because after it's fired, then you have a huge smudge and you're like, oh man, I totally, I slipped on that. Yeah. So you really have to plan on where you're going to hold the piece, like on a pot. The rims are always black, so I know I could handle it there, and I could kind of tilt it to the side or bend upside down, that, you know, and then I can avoid any of the smudges on like the dirty marks. And then the figurative pottery, when they're usually standing up, then I know like their shoes are going to be black, or I usually make them wearing gloves, or their hairline will be black, so I know I could touch it there. But yeah, after it's completely all decorated, we fire it outside and we call it pit fire, but it's above ground, and it's maybe a grate. We have a metal grate that sits above ground, maybe 8 inches, but we have to burn the ground first to make sure it's all completely dry. And we warm it up that way, and have a little kiln shelf that will sit on top of that. And that's where we put our pieces. We fire one at a time. So the figures will be standing upright. The pots are all upside down. So you only have one piece at a time. Once you get it positioned, then you build a little cage around it using chicken wire or any kind of wire that we have, tin roof. And then over that, it has like a breathing room of maybe 8 inches around the whole piece. And this is just to protect the piece from having the cow manure built up around it, from touching it. So we build a cocoon of the cow manure around it, stacking it up, and then we ignite the whole thing. Then you have to ignite it like evenly from all sides so that the smoke and the air pulls directly straight up, not touching the piece. And once it's roaring fire, right, then slowly, about maybe an hour and a half in, then like the cow manure turns into the fuel, and that catches fire finally. And that's fully engulfed in flames, and then we stop feeding it the wood. And once the cow manure is like totally engulfed, then we stop feeding it, and then it burns from the outside in, and that's what our kiln is, I guess. And that's how it is. And what is that material called? Kaolin? Is that what it is?
Like I know that, is a material. Yeah.
It kind of looks like that. I don't know. I'm probably saying it wrong, but it's like that, that like rolled cotton that looks like rolled cotton kind of. Is that what it is maybe? And I've seen people use that like to wrap their pieces in, and it like, you are stepping it into holes. Like if you're doing a soda fire or whatever. And that's what I feel that the commoner does. So it protects the piece that you're firing. But yeah, it gets very hot like that. And then you just let it cool down. Hopefully you don't hear any cracking or popping because you can't see the piece, right? And then you slowly uncover it once it's completely done and the commoner is still intact. It's held up by the chicken wire. You can remove it. And once you like had a little vibration in it, then like it turns all into ashes. But then you see your piece of it survived. And yeah, a lot of the times, like I still have like maybe a 90% survival rate because like all the walls had to be the same size thickness because of how fast we fire and like the expand and contracting of the clay, like it all has to do it evenly. So if there's like any slight air bubble in it, it'll blow up. Or if it's a thick piece, it'll blow up. It's so awesome to know that you could build like a solid piece out of high fire clay and just fire it super slow. You know, we don't have time to stay there for a whole week to let it rise up and then cool off.
What's one more week after a year? Come on, what's another week?
I got to try that. I mean, that's what blew my mind working with Simon, the first person I've ever seen an Atacama kiln. And to fire it and like the community, how it brings together. That's the same sort of feeling that I get in the Pueblo when we have it, when we fire, when we have feast days, ceremonies. That's how it does. It brings everybody together and you have to come together to pull something off. So it's really amazing to learn that type of firing from him. And the openness is an excellent teacher and learning so much from him. And that was his world, the world of wood fire. And my background and his background started connecting that way, telling stories, and I'm learning so much more of who he is and where he came from and what his everybody. It's amazing just to learn each other's background and then to slowly say, okay, let's go collaborate on something. To watch Simon work with color now, it's kind of funny, and I don't know if he's ever done it before, but it's just fun. Like he's carving, you know, he's stepping out of the comfort zone. That's some of the funnest parts and most successful pieces that you never knew you could do. And I'm doing it the same way. I've never carved. I've never wood fired an Atacama kiln, learning how to control the flames or trying to, thinking that you can. Then you're like, oh yeah, I control the flames. No, you didn't. It's just like I got lucky. But just to exchange that knowledge of where we come from and how we work with clay is amazing. So like slowly everything grows and you know, now we have a body of work that some are released like at the in Santa Fe. And then once the Vladim Contemporary Museum opens, like they got held back because of the supply demand for like wood and steel and glass. So their building is slowly going to hopefully be finished by next year, summertime. And then that's when all of Simon's and I collaboration will be released.
Oh, man. Oh, that's going to be, where is that museum going to be at?
It's in Santa Fe. Yeah. Okay. The Rail Yard District. So it's going to be pretty cool to release those and to have all the carvings that like, you know, his background, his culture, tell the story. And it's very similar to indigenous culture and to combine them and to have a storytelling that's really powerful if you want to learn about him.
Yeah, absolutely. What I'm amazed by, and then I'm going to totally dig into the pragmatic. I keep saying this, but the entire making process is so, what's the word, in alignment with the community and the culture as well. Like there's almost no part of this process that can be done as an individual. And what I was hearing you describe earlier is like the culture of the upbringing inside of a Pueblo was such a communal life to begin with that it's only natural in a way that the making of the ceramics physical process is like, you couldn't do this with a small team.
Right.
And the other thing that reflects onto my mind is realizing there literally is always a way to make a living in ceramics with however you want to do it, right? Because the first thing I think about in terms of, oh, you're going to make a living from the things that you make, you know, the numbers have to line up. You have to be able to produce enough, to sell enough, to pay the bills. But when I think about making like, I don't know, is it 5 pieces, 10 pieces, but it's going to take you a year to do it. And you've been doing it for however many years now, and you're still buying groceries. You're still traveling to do different things. Like, it's, that's mind-blowing. That's mind-blowing because how many people are trying to figure out, like, how do I make a mug in 2 minutes less time? I feel like the culture I grew up with was, like, produce, 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 go, go, go.
Mm-hmm.
And here you're able to stand and be like, or not, it's okay.
It's crazy to have these different backgrounds of how to learn from. Like, yes, I mean, I've tried throwing a couple of times, you know, and I can do it, but I don't know. I like, there's just something about the coil and scrape method hand building that I was raised on that I know I can make a huge pot, you know, 29 inches tall using the coil and scrape method. And I don't know how to do that on a wheel. But yeah, definitely you have to, and going back to what I mentioned before about overproducing, right? I understand that and I know it's way bigger than I am. So I do use that knowledge of like, I'm not going to overproduce, but that's why all the other mediums were born. And I have ADD like all over the place. So like I try to learn everything I can. Like it doesn't matter what medium I'm going to work in, but I know I can use it to help in the storytelling of what my purpose is. And so now like getting into fashion and costume design, I've been doing that since I was in high school. And a lot of people are like, oh my God, you do it so much. You're making money on this, making money on that. But I have to remake them or remind them that I've been doing it since I was 16 years old. And now I'm 53. So they're like, oh, okay. Like, you know, oh, you've been doing it for that long. Like, yeah, it's like longer than you've been alive. So that's been.
You knew than I was on Instagram.
Yeah. So it, like once they remember that and, you know, they understand now that you can use fashion, you can become a fashion designer, you can become whatever you want. But I always try to get my hands and learn as much as I can because I know it will help in the future. It will help me. You know, you have to learn the business side of it. And I know I wanted to talk with you and your audience about that is like, if you're serious about going into making a life as an artist, as a potter, anything, like you have to learn the administration part of it. There, you have to have paid taxes, you have to have a business plan, you have to support yourself and protect your intellectual property. And there are ways to do that. And you learn it along the way. And that's how I learned it from the ground up. But yeah, you have to definitely to put yourself on the internet. And you know, if you're very proud of a style, like you should invest in yourself and protect your intellectual property, start filing that, you know, understand that part of it, because you'll get ripped off and, you know, no matter what. And especially indigenous people, like, you know, a lot of people say, I'm inspired by indigenous work. You know, no, it's called plagiarism. Like, you know,
and
tell,
I'm white.
Tell the people of how, like, where you got it from. And it's like, it's so cool because, like, I had the opportunity to work with Donna Karan in 2002 and 2003. And like the magnitude and of how huge she was, still as a creator, she approached me and asked me, do you want to collaborate? And here it is. So like I got full credit for everything. She shared all of her knowledge and there are ways to work with people on that level. And I'm just so happy that Tish and I knew how to operate with contracts and non-disclosures and all this different type of behind the scenes, like lawyerly stuff, right? We have lawyers for the copyrights specifically for that. And I've been doing it like for over 2 decades working that way. And you have to learn that business because you'll get effed over if you don't. And you just have to look out for yourself and look out for your business. So that is like a huge, you have to learn it. And anybody that comes to me, I can direct them into how to do this. Even if I don't know how to do it, I can, you know, I'll be your friend and help you try to figure it out. But there are ways to do it, but you have to do it. Otherwise you're risking being plagiarized and, you know, taken advantage of.
Yeah, totally. Well, getting into that business side of things, what is the mix of things, for lack of a better word? How do you guys actually keep the light on and how big? Because I also want people to get an understanding of like, it's not just you doing all of this stuff for like, you've got a team behind you.
Oh, yeah.
Which for my brain even adds to the amazement of the longevity of how long it takes you to make work, and you're providing a living for other people while not overproducing, is like the most countercultural thing to 2022 life in the United States or in the Western world, or I don't know, like I'm going to generalize everything, but you know, like that's unheard of. And it is such a welcome relief, frankly, you know, that you can figure it out.
I think the best advice I can do is take baby steps, learn everything like inside and out as much as you can. You'll save yourself a shitload of money if you do like take the time to learn it and, you know, don't jump into something really quick and spend all your money on something and then you get no return. But if you take your time, figure out, you know, do ask questions of anybody, any artist that is out there. Most of them will, I mean, it's hard for me not to share my knowledge because that's how the whole world moves forward is you share the knowledge, pass it on, pay it forward. And when you do that, you get more in return as well. Now, you know what? I mean, that's cliche, but it's true. But if you're able to help somebody do it, and then just imagine you're anybody that's asking you, you're at that point at once in your life. So do what you wish your mentor or whoever you looked up to would have done for you. So yeah. Be that person, be that good guy, and it's really cool. Do it with a free will, your free heart, and more will come to you. But yeah, definitely, it's like just slow down and get a plan. I mean, that's what I learned. And then now I'm like, oh, they call it a business plan. Oh, that's what that is. And of course, like I told you, I didn't go to higher education, but it is. It's true. That's how we figured it out. And just like you have to have that business plan. Like, what do you expect? Like, how many hours are you willing to dedicate it? If you want to make a living on it, you're going to have to dedicate, you know, eat it, breathe it, live it. And if you're willing to do that without giving up, like there's always places you're going to fail, but look at failures as our teachers, as our professors. They're the best teachers that we could have. Don't be afraid of failing because you will. I still fail and I'm happy to do it because I'm learning more. So the more you fail, the quicker you're going to learn and figure stuff out what you want to do. But definitely look into how you can take your venture into a business form and to really figure out, like, how am I going to get into this gallery? What do I expect? Go talk to them before you commit, just because, like, you get to open and break that ice and open, like, a conversation with them and say, this is what I really want to do. Go as prepared as you can with all kinds of ideas and images and, you know, would you guys want to do this? Most of the time, if it's something that they've never done, they'll either be scared, which is awesome because that is like a new venture. You know, if you're not scared, you're not growing. So if you're comfortable, then you're like, yeah, it's been done. But then you're not really making any progress. So go in there with huge ideas and you always could go in there with the biggest ideas, the highest goal, because you could always chop it down. And then like when you chop it down, you still have already met your original goals without knowing it. And you're like, oh shit, that was easier than I thought. So there are ways to do it and just like believe in yourself and go try it. Go try anything. When you fail, don't cry. Just accept it and turn it to a learning lesson.
Yeah. So what does the actual kind of structure of Virgil Ortiz Creations? You've got you. I know you've got you and Tish, who's like your, I don't know her official art manager.
Yeah, she's everything. I mean,
admin
she knows
extraordinaire.
More, yeah, she knows more about my life than I do. Because like, I mean, she's a Virgo. Yeah, we have the episode of her and Charles King of King Galleries. Was one of my first galleries that I worked with over 2 decades. And he was a very traditional gallerist. And when I came into, we connected, I was like, hey, what can we do this? Can we, you know, these are, you know, never before created pieces out of Kojiti, but they're traditional clay and methods. So he was like, what the hell are you talking about? This is like, I don't know if I can sell that. I'm like, oh, you will. So like, it just, you just trial and error, you have to go through it. And like Tish and I have been working for over 2 decades as well, since we're cousins. Everybody thinks we're married because we're always working together all the time.
Your work wife.
Yeah, it's kind of funny how it all just turns out. But like we had ups and downs and we have to just figure it out. Now it's really well oiled and we know what to expect. Like she's the admin part. I'm the artist. Charles is the gallerist when we're doing shows like that. But all these different mediums that we do work in, she's always on phone calls, on emails, and scheduling everything. Whereas, like, I had to invest in a manager, and she was the perfect person to do it. And we figured our way out. And, like, again, like anything that you do, the more of it, you're going to learn more to do that. Mm-hmm. So take the time if you want to work with someone. It could be whoever, you know, like, is going to help you, but you're going to figure that out. And like when we do all different museum shows, exhibitions, the more it grows, like the more hands I need to help. So then we'll do work for hire jobs or collaboratives or whatever and figure out a business point of view from it and to really bring in more people, because the more people you bring into your group, as far as creatives, you're going to learn what they learn. And me being a control freak as a kid, I learned how to trust other people because I know they can do it better than I can. but at the same time, I'm learning from them. So that gets another instilled way of how to work. So like I learned how to do Photoshop just by sitting next to my friend when I was still art directing, but I didn't know, I'd never had a computer until not too long ago, but it was just funny how I learned Photoshop just from watching him do the digitize everything. And then like photography, I used to hire photographers to help me do that, but I ended up buying myself a Nikon D200 back in the day, and I started doing it myself. So you learn more and more, you save yourself money by learning how to do it yourself, and the time, especially like because other people are so busy, they don't have time to get a saved, you know, clean up an image and get it ready for print, where you have that skill now and you can save all that money and just do it yourself in your vamp hours when you're working at midnight and just like really get into it, and you can do whatever you want with it. So you're now in control. That helped a lot too. But then now you're able to drop it out when we go into like all the different mediums that I work in, like when we go into say the fashion manufacturing, right? Usually it's like just me and Tish working on that and like the immediate core team. But then there's different projects that we do that the team gets really huge. When we go into, say, manufacturing, like that includes like the cotton mill, the cut and sew people, the dye houses, the printing, the manufacturing, the everything about that, then that the team grows to like at least 25 people. So everybody's working together and you're just like, okay, you know, the team has got huge. But then you're working on manufacturing like clothing, garments, whatever, handbags. Like we have to go, and that's like under my Made in Native America label. And, you know, it's made for all, worn by all. You don't have to be indigenous to wear this, but what the meaning behind Made in Native America is that we keep the manufacturing here in the United States. We have all of the leather is from the U.S. You look at a handbag, the snaps, the feet, the closure, the zippers, the hardware on everything, that's all manufactured in Los Angeles. Our people that put together the handbags are in Los Angeles, so everything is made here, and that's what that little subsidiary under the Virgil Ortiz brand is. So it's like you just have to think of what you're doing and protect yourself at all times. And it's pretty cool once you start making any steps to be having like a more successful plan that you're just creating out of nowhere when it works, and then you're like, oh, okay, cool, I know how to do this now. And that goes as far as like working with galleries or with exhibitions, museum exhibitions. Like I love to have meetings with the people, the curators, the directors, and say like, I would love to do a show. I said, okay, but here's my images. Here's like the type of work I'm going to feature in this show. I would love to do wall coverings. I love to make this special pedestal. I like to do projections. I want to do, you know, combine everything. So you're basically designing a whole exhibition. And the more images that are finished and polished and really quality, the more that you're going to be able to help the entity that is going to give you that gallery, that showing. You learn how to interact with these teams and how to get the confidence of two that they're like, oh yeah, I can trust you. He knows what he's doing. Even though a lot of times I don't know what I'm doing, but it's just all a trial and error to do a new show, but it always works out. It's like, it's amazing. Like even with Meow Wolf, right? That is now open in Santa Fe, the Meow Wolf Santa Fe and exhibition. Like I had to take a huge step back. I had to take a huge step back because of now the public, like a heavy foot traffic, and they're going to interact with it. They're going to take selfies. They're going to touch it, climb it. I had to design artwork for an installation that would be able to take that kind of traffic. Whereas I was normally having my pieces behind glass or on a pedestal in a museum where nobody touches it. So that was an exciting way to try how to do an installation and do video. So like I worked on it for a whole year, producing like all the different types of the ceramics that will go in for photography, then creating the costuming, like all the material, the foam fabrication, the vinyl, the latex, the leather, the metal, the resin, the plastics, everything that goes into creating a costume. We get the model together, hand paint their face, dress them, get the site, get all the models to wherever we're going, rent tons of hotel rooms, do the photo shoot, get all the material, get it to another one of my friends that's going to edit it. I create the own music you see in a lot of my installations with help from different friends.
I was like just shaking my head in disbelief of this list of things that you are doing. Like, what? Sorry for that abrupt ending there, my friends. We had a bit of technology snafu amidst recording this video before we got started, during it, and all of that. But I knew that there were already so many gems of wisdom in this conversation that I couldn't let an awkward ending keep this talk from all of you. Essentially, in the remaining couple of minutes, I was simply acknowledging how Virgil has a way of pairing together the philosophical and the pragmatic. He has a team of people who his work provides jobs for, and yet also, he's able to pause, trust the process, and know in the core of his being that he is doing the work he was made to do. There's no other option than for it to work out. My tendency towards being a control freak needs to probably re-listen to this conversation another 5 times at least to really get that to sink in. If you love today's conversation as much as I did, please share to let Virgil and me know. Snap a screenshot or share what you're making as you've listened and tag us on Instagram at Virgil Ortiz and at The Maker's Playbook. I'd love to connect and say thanks. And speaking of connecting, I'm going to Enseca for the first time this year. For those of you that don't know, Enseca stands for the National Council on Education for the Ceramic Arts, NCECA. And it's a big, huge conference here in the United States. This year it's in Cincinnati, so while it's a long drive, we can actually drive there. So that's what Francesco and I are going to be doing to make it happen. And thanks to the always lovely Ben Carter from the Tales of the Red Clay Rambler podcast, as well as the Brickyard Network, we're going to be doing a live taping of the podcast at Enseca. It's slated for Thursday at 1 p.m. I have no idea what room yet, but I'll be sharing more of information as I have it on Instagram and, of course, in our email newsletter. So if you don't want to miss out on those kind of updates, you can pop on over to makersplaybook.com/newsletter to add your email to the list. That's also the list that gets our monthly free photo tips. I have a couple of fun and sneaky ideas I'm playing around with for things like free podcast swag that I hopefully will have ready in time for Enseca. So if you're planning on going, you'll definitely want to be on that email list to find out more once I work out the details. One more time, that is makersplaybook.com/newsletter. With all of my gratitude, the Maker's Playbook podcast continues to be sponsored by Amoco.
Hi, I'm Kara, content creator and Facebook wrangler for Amoco Brand, bringing you ideas and support for your creative adventures every day. This week's episode is brought to you by Amoco Brent. Find your favorite Amoco glaze at your local distributor. Happy glazing!
Additionally, audio post-production of this podcast is made possible by help from Christy Katsavan, with promotional material assistance from Queenie Malachi. The Maker's Playbook podcast is recorded on the original homelands of the Potawatomi, Ho-Chunk, and Menominee people, where the people of Wisconsin's Sovereign, Anishinaabe, Ho-Chunk, Menominee, Oneida, and Mohican nations remain present. Until next time, my friends, go get back to making your dreams a reality. Because together, we've got this.